Welcome to the Open Adoption Project. This is episode 109. We're the Nelsons. I'm Lynette.
And I'm Sean. And in today's episode, we have a conversation between Alicia Gallagher, our Director of Communications, and Stephen Rowley. We're going to go ahead and just jump straight to that conversation, and Alicia will introduce Stephen, and of course, Lynette and I will share a few thoughts at the end of the episode. We're also going to have a little bonus content at the conclusion of our episode, which invites birth mothers to participate in a research study.
Yeah, we are really thankful for Dr. Rowley for sharing these thoughts. This is a really enjoyable episode. We really enjoyed listening to this, and we're so grateful for him and for Alicia.
Okay, welcome everybody. We have Stephen Rowley here on the podcast with us. Stephen Rowley is a psychotherapist practicing in Washington State. He also worked as an elementary school teacher, principal, and college professor. He holds a master's in psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institute and a PhD in administration and policy analysis from Stanford University. He's also an adoptee and an adoptive father. His new book is The Lost Coin, a memoir of adoption and destiny. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Just from that intro, you've done a lot of different things in your career. And I'm curious, why write about this topic and why now? It seems like there would be some sort of urgency behind the moment of writing it at this moment.
Yeah, I'll back up here with the timeliness, I'll put it that way. So why the topic? Well, as you know from the book, I knew from my earliest days I was adopted, that it wasn't until I was 13 that I, after kind of a rift with my mother, that I became ever more determined to find out my identity, my birth mother, the circumstances of my adoption, which were shielded legally through sealed records. And to this day, I don't know exactly what more my parents knew or didn't know about my background. I don't think it was probably less than I think. But I spent up until age 40, in fact, I was living in Redwood City at the time, when I finally, after a long detective the story about how I found who she was, where she was living, and then flew back to the East Coast to actually meet her. So that was such a seminal moment in my life, and for hers as well. I mean, it's emotionally just too big to really even describe. I've tried to describe it. I think I do a good job at that, but still that something, that impact, all that it meant to both her and me. And so, yeah, so several years later, my wife and I adopted a four-year-old, and that was a monumental discovery and falling in love at a time with our son-to-be, at a time we had absolutely no reason whatsoever. We were vowed. My wife was a teacher. I was a principal at the time, or a central office administrator. We didn't want kids in our lives. We're with kids all day, so we want to have our adult time later.
Right.
That all changed with one kid, and it would still be true after him, but this one we had to have. So that's this whole story, how adoption came into my life. And then I would say, although I wrote about it and certainly considered, I really didn't have the drive to find my birth father, partly because my efforts were thwarted by the fact that the records I had misspelled his name. So it wasn't until much later. So then come to just a little over 2 years ago, I got a 23andMe notification from a first cousin, which was unusual. I belonged to 23andMe almost from its beginning. So I'm really used to getting these notifications for second, third cousins, which right. I realized, forget it. I mean, it adds up to nothing. But this one was a first cousin. And this person lived in the Midwest, and I'll make the story short. Within minutes, we discovered, and he suggested, he got his mother in touch with me, and his other aunt, who was a genealogist, got in touch with me, and I realized in a flash, after I gave them some information about what I did know about my birth father, which was exactly the right information, it was like instance, like suddenly I knew his name. He had died in the late 80s. I knew his name. I now knew I had four half-sisters who live in the Midwest, most of them in the Midwest, and we're all relatively close in age. So we exchanged pictures and stories and all that stuff. So, but I'd say from the moment that I heard that I hadn't really found him, but he came my way, it was as though the light went on. It's like, okay, now it's time to write. So I've been involved in writing a good deal of my life. But this one, I just, boy, it just spilled. And so I wrote within a day or two, I wrote 5 or 6 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week until Labor Day. So I had a first draft done in 5 months. Of course, then there's a whole other story once you get a draft and all the other things that happen.
Yes. Yes.
In terms of getting it right. But that was that discovery really marked kind of that was the bookend or the missing third. I mean, I found her, now I found him. Although I never had the drive, but nevertheless, it was interesting, particularly when I saw the pictures of both of them. My birth mother, I had her picture for a long time, and she was a charming and beautiful young woman. I likened her to a kind of a young Jean Tierney, movie star from the 40s.
Okay.
And when I saw my father's picture, same age, at age 19, my age, I was not only looking at me, it looked like, of course, I'm romanticizing now, but it looked so much like the young Ernest Hemingway, who I just happened to still like.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it just sort of everything clicked. Because, oh my God, I had these two really good looking parents. On the other hand, I already knew that that he had wanted nothing to do with me or my life then. Mm-hmm. And certainly, whereas she, I think, had a deep yearning to reconnect with me, just didn't have the means to do so. She, mm-hmm. after she gave me up for adoption, she was married soon after to another man, and largely did not have a very happy life at all.
Yeah.
Plagued by drug addiction, alcoholism. And when I caught up with her when I was about 40 back east, she had recently been released from a halfway house. So the place where we met was in state-sponsored housing, a kind of a dingy tenement. And at first she was quite hostile. I mean, when my half-sister who brought me there, who I'd only known for a few hours, knocked in the door, and she opened the door crack, looked at me and said, who the hell gave you the right to look me up? I didn't ask you to come.
Mm.
I was like, time to breathe.
Yeah. So that probably wasn't what you were expecting, or were you expecting that? Were you anticipating some?
Well, I don't know what I was expecting. God knows where everybody was nervous, but I wasn't expecting that. I mean, she knew I was coming. But after a little back and forth, I brought her some flowers, which she said she'd never given her flowers before, which was, you know, just like, oh my God. But then it's in the book, I won't go into detail now, but once we were in the kitchen, I began to realize just how bright she was. And I also realized then and later how much she had sacrificed. I got the break. I got to live in a great house, supportive parents, affluent by Midwestern standards at that time, supportive of education, supportive of me. I had a privilege from the beginning.
I want to actually go into that a little bit. There was a part where I believe it was your sister who had written you a letter, and she said, I hope you know now that you were spared. You were the lucky one. And to read, like, how did you read that? I mean, because there's so many adoption stories where you imagine that maybe you didn't end up as lucky as the biological family. Maybe you were placed for adoption and then they went off and made this other life and you missed out. But here you have a family member saying, no, you were the lucky one. How did that hit you?
I think at the time, and certainly since then, it seemed like such a conundrum, because on one hand, you're left with, as I talk about this, the inner life, the indelible imprint of this separation of mother and child, the primal wound stays with you. It creates a sense of yearning, wanting to connect, wanting to find who it is, wanting to reestablish it. At the same time, realizing, well, if that hadn't happened, I would have been with her either as a boy with a single mother, or maybe with a man she didn't want to be with. I realized just how bad that would have been. So it's like, God, yeah, I escaped. So I want to connect, and I'm glad I escaped. That's a kind of mm-hmm. push and pull, and I think the both are true.
Yeah, I do. And adoptees live with that. From mm-hmm. my conversations with so many, that you want to connect, but you have all these questions about this at the same time, or you're happy about reunifying, but also sad for what you lost,
right.
Or it's just so many opposites that live at the same time in perpetuity.
Right. We Jungian psychotherapists call that Jung's idea of the tension of the opposites.
Mm.
And to hold two ideas, whether this is a good example, hold both to be true. And in terms of therapy or even just the academic reading of Jung and so forth, The importance is to be patient with those obstacles, not try to resolve, to choose a story. You know, like, you know, oh, I by all means, I always wanted to get back together. Well, yeah, but there was the other side, you're an idiot if you did. So, but I think by holding those for as long as I did, and still today, it's created a dialectic. It created a new fusion, a new sort of resolution. And so that and later in the book, it took me to a very different place with some of the ritual things I experienced when I could change my perspective out of me being the child and my mother being the adult, not my birth mother, my real mom. And because I'd never talked to her about it after we had our big riff, I never talked to her. I swore I never would. But I had a revelation, actually was on her 100th birthday, when I saw my relationship with my mom and what I was doing all of my life and what she was doing, completely different, as though I were the teacher and she was the student. And then everything changed. So by hanging out with that, those opposites, it didn't seem like it involved my mom, who I grew up with, was my mom. Something else emerged out of that that was unexpected and brought enormous resolution. And my mom died a year after, on her 101st birthday. By the time she left, all of my little petty jealousies and chip on the shoulder with her, and maybe hers with me, just vanished. Wow. And it was such a sweet ending, because when going to her funeral and all that kind of thing, I just felt such enormous gratitude and connection with her, and such a deeper affinity and love for her that I hadn't experienced before. So I can't prove that happened because of holding on to those opposites, at least rationally, but part of my own training is that you have to relate intuitively, as you do, I think, in terms of where you find your meaning, where not every adoptee wants to find their parent, nor should everybody, it should, because sometimes there's people you don't want to be reunited with. Yeah. And sometimes certain information from you, legally or otherwise, is blocked from you. It's a hard pill to swallow. I've met plenty of people that's been the circumstance. Many people actually who are from where I was born, in the Willis Maternity Sanitarium in Kansas City. I did a last February, on my 75th birthday, I did a reading there with a friend who was a historian of the Willows. Kansas City at that time was the hub of adoption in the United States for probably four decades, a big center, and they had maybe 10 or 12 different homes for unwed mothers. The Willows was sort of it was called the Ritz. They advertised back in New York newspapers and magazines. So a lot of people came from the East Coast to bring their unwed, their pregnant daughters. But there, we did a speech on the second day, we did a speech at the Kansas City Library, and most everybody who came to the speech, pretty good sized group, were connected to the Willows. Either they were born there or they had a friend or relative who was there. So those are moments where you start to hear the stories. Mm-hmm. You start to hear the theme of this sort of like either the joy or the frustration of linking up. Never one way or the other, use that under that dynamic underneath the surface of it, this kind of like yearning for reconnection. Now that's not always true. I would never claim that's true for all people. But for some people, it's repressed. It may be true, but it's in the unconscious. How do we know it's in the unconscious? So, but many adoptees trying to find their records, trying to find the distant relative, or trying to find where that person might be buried is a powerful driving force that I dare say you have to be in those shoes to understand it. Because it doesn't, logically, you can't make a case for it, but intuitively and emotionally, absolutely.
Yeah, yep. So back to your experience being kind of unique, did you feel like your desire to explore your adoption story was discouraged growing up? And that's why you decided,
two levels. One, it was discouraged, of course, by my mom, who, when I said I would like to know more, and she said, you know, kind of in so many words, how dare you, don't you think we love you enough? And I was so embarrassed. I was so humiliated and so angered by that. I ran out of my room, ran to my room, slammed the door, and swore I'd never bring this up again. I didn't want to experience that kind of humiliation. So I just simply went on my way. And at that age, when I was 13, I knew I'd have to wait to get to college before I had my own mailing address. I couldn't be mailing. There are no cell phones or, you know, no Google, no anything. Now, the second layer to that was that, and this is often the case, the people at my adoption agency in Ottumwa, Iowa, were paternalistic would be a polite way to put it. I sent numerous letters. I kept copies of my correspondence and theirs. And, you know, they tried to be was kind of like, oh, you know, sorry, I can't help you. You know, go have a good future.
Mm-hmm.
We can't help you. And always like, well, the law says we can't give you anything. So in time, by the time I got into my early 30s, there was a new director there and who had a totally different disposition. I had helped him write a letter to the Iowa State Senate when they're trying to get some of the rules changed. So we were already friendly. And I wrote again, say, what's changed? What can I have? And he kind of said, on one hand, the letter said, well, these records are sealed. And then inside, there's a little piece of paper. He says, here's something that's not sealed. Maybe this will help. Well, it had everything I wanted to know. My birth mother's name, her hometown,
wow.
The name of my birth father, where he went to college, where they both worked. It was like, I saw that. It was like jackpot. It was like,
yeah.
I knew then. I was then the hunt was on.
Yeah.
And that,
well,
that
that's so interesting that you, there's some people who get a little bit of information at a time over a long period of time, but it sounds like so much information that you got was all at once. We were just turning on the lights.
Well, I got dribs and drabs, but nothing that really like cinched it. And this one did cinch it. Now that said, of course, then there's other, you know, the other things. Okay. Well, now I know her name. I know where she lived. I talk in the book about going to her hometown in Iowa. Showing up at the high school, which like an idiot, I forgot was closed in the summer. I should know as an educator. And then, so I went to the public library and asked for a yearbook. Those are, I'm in my, this is the 80s, right? I'm in my, you know, look like Tom Selleck. bushy.
And in the Midwest, no less, where.
I got my flip flops, it's drip, it's super hot. I come into and ask the person, the woman at the desk, if she had a, whatever year it was, 1942 yearbook. And she looked at me like, what do you want with that? And it turned out because of paper shortage, she says, I don't think we have them. There was paper shortage. So they didn't even have covers for things. Let me see what I can find. Well, she did. And then after I did enough searching, I finally found the picture with her name. And when I saw that picture, I think she was probably 15 or 16 at the time, which would have been roughly my sophomore, junior year. I was looking at me. I was looking, if I'd have been a girl, that's what I would have looked like. Now, from that, again, difficulties. Okay, now I know that she is who she is, but where does she live? So at that point, I'd stole a telephone book, brought it back to the Bay Area, and wrote everybody in the county with the same last name and explaining that it was for a purpose of a reunion. I didn't say who I was. By then, I was a doctor. And she had been a nurse, so I led it to think, like, well, doctor, nurse, reunion, maybe it's a hospital thing. I heard nothing for a long time from anybody. I must have sent out 20 of those. One day, a small envelope came in, single piece of paper, really small, had her name, including her married name. And I think it had her address. I think it had her address and town where she was from. That's all. It didn't say anything else. That's all I needed. So as you see from the book, I sat down and wrote her a letter, which I'm glad I kept a copy of that. And then that letter was intercepted. So there's these obstacles all along the way.
Yep.
No one said, oh, the doors are open. Here we go. It's like, well, then I had to, you know, well, we don't know if we can see her. The psychiatrist, I'm thinking psychiatrist. Well, now I find out she's been at a halfway house. And at some point after exchange of letters and phone calls, I realized just how bad off she had been. And my position with my new half-sisters was, I'm coming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming. No, I will not. I will comply with not meeting her if that's what it comes to, but I will see her. If I have to stand across the street, I'm going to see her. So by the time all that happened, finally the way was clear, and I got to meet her in person. As I say, at the beginning of that, it was really tough. After that, the doors opened to our souls. I understood everything I needed to know about her and her with me. It was a reunion. I realized how much she and her other three kids from another marriage had been waiting for me to show up. One sister said, oh, there was always another chair at the table. We always thought it'd be yours.
So they knew about you?
Oh, yeah. When are you going to show up? So, but like I say, the one son I've never met, he lives in the Midwest. The other two, one's deceased and one is still living back in back in the East Coast, and we've had scattered correspondence since then. But when you're the one who's the adoptee, making yourself known to a family who's a family member has been responsible for your birth, it's not the dynamic is not the same. I'm like, here I am. It's like, you know, and they're kind of like, you know, well, like in the case of my birth father's family, they certainly were polite and they answered most questions I had. But it's like, well, you're just reminding us that, and it turned out, I think two of them were already born by the time I was conceived.
Oh, now, okay.
See what I mean? Mm-hmm. Difficult. I mean, even though their mother is no longer alive, but I don't think they want to ask. I got the feeling, don't ask them more questions about her or what we knew about our dad. Mm-hmm. Too painful. And I have to respect that. So, but that's okay. I did what I wanted to do, and I knew where my limits were. I mean, I think one of them may be coming out here this summer, but I'll be happy to meet. I've seen their family pictures. And I kind of look at, you know, all four of the quote girls all got married, all had children, a huge family. And I look at, if you take the actual blood lineage and look at the faces and kind of go, yeah, I see myself in every one of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, now they're, by Midwestern standards, very traditional, conservative, kind of Republican types. And I was kind of raised that way, but I'm a West Coast, as you are, living in a blue state. So we're not living mm-hmm. in it. Mm-hmm. And she told that one of them said, she said, it's a good thing you weren't around when my dad was still alive. I said, you'd have never gotten along. You know, you never. Now, athletically, would have been very similar, but our, you know, that just shows you how life takes you in a different direction. So,
yeah, it really does. Did your birth mom and your mom ever meet, or was your mom alive when you had this reunification experience with your birth mom?
My mom was alive, and I eventually found out that she found out about my reunion. She never brought it up. And I never
didn't tell her. Okay. So you kept that vow that you made that you didn't want
to. Well, I call it more like a grudge. And of course, it's embarrassing to say now, but like I say, at the end of her life, we had a, without words, a major reconciliation that made my perspective of what her world was like adopting me. Mm-hmm. So I was 6 months old. She didn't think she was ever going to have kids. Actually, the adoption agent actually picked me to be with them. They didn't come and pick me. They said, we have the boy that's going to be right for you in terms of development and early IQ testing. My dad's a surgeon. She's a nurse. Mm-hmm. So that part really worked out well. So, but I know that I think she had to have been enormously nervous about adopting me and unsure about her own capacity. You know, you get a six-month-old big strapping boy and suddenly here you go, take him home. It's like, you know, so now I do know that they had their close friends in town were aware of me being adopted, but my dad was well known in town. I don't think many people knew or cared that I was adopted. So it was never, to my knowledge, most people never knew all the way through high school that I was adopted. And I didn't go advertising it either. So people, which happens with my son,
But they did talk to you about it. You knew from the time you were young that you were adopted.
Yeah.
It was until.
Yeah.
Okay.
And many people would say, oh, you know, you look so much like your dad. And people say that about my son. They go, oh, you look so much like your dad. So, brown eyes. Well, you have brown eyes. So, you know, brown eyes will get you.
Yeah. People like to look for the similarities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you know, there was for me, my temperament being with the parents I was raised with is, I was just born to be independent. I was exposed to things that I talk about in the book at an early age that were different than most of my classmates growing up. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm going back. The death of one of my classmates is, two of them have died in the last couple of weeks. I'm going back and I went a couple weeks. But my grandparents had a big hand in raising me. As I talk in the book in the beginning, be exposed to race and racism at an early age, being exposed to the fact that even then, I may not have the words for it, but we lived in a nice big house across the street from the Golf and Country Club. I didn't think of us being rich because I don't think we were rich, but I realized that most of the other people I went to school with were a few others like me and others who were middle class and below that. And so I realized, you know, like we were definitely schooled not to, you know, like keep yourself humble. Mm-hmm. You know, don't brag about what your blessings you do have. So that was good lesson. Still, I was aware that I had opportunities. In fact, one of the people who died just 3 days ago, who was a childhood friend from fourth grade, and we played sports all together all the way through high school. I realized even then that I knew I was going to college. There was never a question. And my friend certainly had the smarts for it, and eventually did. But it was really clear that the emphasis in his family, kind of working class, now you got to work, you got to pay your way, work menial jobs, go to the least expensive place you can eventually go to after community college. So the bar was set in my mind, this is a judgment I realized, set low for him and other classmates, just kind of like, hey, in our hometown of the 60s, you can make a decent living with it working in a factory. You can have a small house and raise a family. Of course, that's impossible today. Mm-hmm. But that's a kind of like, well, what a gift to have this. My grandmother, I think, willed that for both my mom, for my dad and his sister, my aunt, to not grow up to be farmers. One became a teacher, one became a doctor. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of I was raised in that environment where I was never lectured whatsoever about, you got to go to college. It's like, well, you're going. It's like, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you're going.
It's a given.
It's just that something else. There's something when you look back, you write a memoir like this, and even today, even with clients and so forth, that you realize the hand of fate. How do things turn out the way they do? Luck and bad luck put together. Somehow it's not just decisions by me or somebody else or choices we make. And that's that kind of where the title of the book comes in, this sort of ineffable quality of mystery, at least where I ended up and how I assess the arc of all that we're talking about as being guided by forces that I can't account for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rationally.
Yeah. Well, it's fortunate you've had that experience to be able to reflect and write about it, and the forgiveness almost that's happened for your mom and for your birth mom to just understand why they felt the way they did, why they made the decisions they did. And even in the letter that you wrote to your birth mom, the themes that you write are similar to what I've heard from other adoptees, that I hold no ill will toward you. I just want to meet you. I just want to see you. But the story and the narrative that some of the birth moms are telling themselves is, I couldn't possibly try to look for him. He might hate me. He might resent me for making the decision I did. But I haven't heard that from any adoptees. All they want, and what you express wanting, is, I just want to meet you.
I mean, as a writer, of course, I'm trying to create some drama and pathos. If you don't mind, if I just read one short paragraph.
Sure.
This is after I've been to her place. I come back the second day. I meet her roommate, who's schizophrenic, who she introduces to me as her son, which took my breath away. She just said that later. She was, even when I asked her, do you remember my birthday? She said, of course I do. Mm-hmm. You're my son. You have a mom and a dad, but I'm still your mother, and I don't forget mm-hmm. that. So this is when I'm leaving. Again, this is a dingy tenement back in the East Coast. It's cold. It's December. Later that evening, we hugged as I stood to leave, but I can't remember how much after that. I do recall we held each other closely for a long time. We both knew that we might not see each other again. Before I opened the door, I brushed a few strands of her wig back and gently caressed and kissed her forehead with with total loving deliberation. Then I was gone, out the door. I kept my head down as I walked into the freezing evening air in a neighborhood I knew I would never visit again. So that's that kind of like,
yeah.
Now, did I actually think that at that moment? It seemed utterly obvious, because I was going back to the West Coast. Oh, I had a job. She was not in very good health. We didn't, you know, I knew I'd still be in touch with it. Yeah, she wrote a letter to, but it just wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter. I don't think for a second I doubt that the connection and depth with which I connected with her was reciprocal with her. You can't top that. I mean, that was what we wanted to accomplish. I thoroughly believe we were both kind of like coming from such a different place in time. And yet, as I say in the book, I said the last time we held each other like that, I was 10 days old. So, okay, admittedly, nostalgic, okay?
Yes, definitely.
Same reason going back to Kansas City on my birthday, the 75th birthday. Nostalgic, for sure.
Yeah.
Yet, I think for the audience there were 30,000 of us born at the Willows. Mm. That's a lot of kids in four, wow. several decades, and many of whom were there, and they all got it.
Yep. How nice to be surrounded with people who get it, because there's so much explanation that is sometimes required if someone doesn't get it. Like, why are you searching? Yeah. Why do you have these questions? Why do you? Why don't you? And it's just easier to be with people who have witnessed it or have experienced it firsthand. Thank you for reading that. I appreciate that. So we have, I just have one more question for you before we wrap up. You are a psychotherapist. Do you work with adoptees?
That's a really good question. No, not particularly, no.
Okay.
Despite all the notoriety and publicity and so forth, I haven't had a lot of people come to me. I'm trying to remember, I have an intake. I have a lot of people in your first session have some intake information. It sounds stupid to say it this way. I don't think I have a question of whether they were adopted, but usually as you get to know the client pretty well. But no, I'm not shopping myself as some sort of a adoption therapist. What I do in terms of my handle, my specialty is about a trauma. So what I've labeled as the separation of mother and child as a form of developmental trauma, it disrupts a normal development. Let's not say it's fatal, but it does affect you, leaves that imprint. Now, you could take other kinds of trauma, sexual trauma, violence, abandonment, abuse, physical. So those are kind of running in parallel. So the trauma, the response to trauma, or the telltale imprints of trauma, and the ways in which people in one or two ways predictably respond over time to that, not always in a healthy way. That's what I understand. That's what I think it's my. Mm-hmm. So I see through that lens. Not everybody, but I have a sniffer for that. And what with our son, as I talk about the book, when he was 4 years old, his birth mother had just been killed in an accident. His birth father was living halfway around the world and wasn't coming back. I understood something in him. I knew something in him from the moment I saw him. And I liken it to seeing the sense of a miner trapped in a mine deep down. And I think my wife and I both, in so many words, we wouldn't have said it this way, but I think on a metaphoric level, it's our job to rescue him. I mean, bring that little one back out. And I think for those facing the possibility of foster care and so forth, it's an appreciation for what you don't know.
Yes.
What you can't know. You can have a pretty darn good guess. Maybe we can talk about that offline sometime. But that I think begins to inform how the premise of one of the themes, if you will, of the book is that on the workaday level, the stories of our lives, the who you went to school with and who raised you and who you fell in love with and who you divorced from and what job you have, all that external life, all really important. We have to navigate all that. But the depth psychological perspective dealing with the unconscious brings in the fact there's an inner life. And we as in the adoption community, my argument is that many of us, not all, but many of us are much more similar because we've been affected by that initial primal wound of separation. Some people don't care, don't know, don't believe it. Fine. Others dial right into that. And it's just that kind of, I said, if we were, our adoption community had a theme song, it'd be Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. How does it feel to be on your own, a complete unknown, no direction home, like a rolling stone?
Mm-hmm.
That yearning of that song, when I revisited that many times, and I read that to that group in Kansas City, they're like, you could hear the whole audience just gasp, like, yeah.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
Like a rolling stone. Mm-hmm. Now, so we have, as I say in the book, this is a psychological construct. We have these inner archetypes. So for us, I argue, at least among those that we have, shares that orphan archetype, that our orphan energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the lives can be different. What you think of as an orphan and what I think of art is irrelevant to that energetic presence that makes us always in a perpetual state of low grade yearning. Even when we find our birth parents, I still have it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think long reconciled that like as though that's a big fat bummer. Why can't I keep feeling that way? Realizing this energy, this sort of quest to know more, this curiosity that it creates, has been what's made me.
And does today.
I'm doing a course right now on my teaching about some of these subjects, and I've got another book in mind. You know, in later life, getting the creative itch, it's got to get scratched. I mean, I that's that kind of curiosity. Like it got a good taste of what it's like to be really creative and write a book. Well, now I'm on a roll. Without that orphan archetype banging around in there, say I want to find out more. I dare say that might not have happened. Who knows?
Well, that makes sense then why you'd want to write it now, because you got the two pieces of your story that you didn't know anything about from your birth mom and your birth father. And you could write the story. You could look back with all the information and perspective you have. But you're right that the searching and the yearning becomes a part of an adoptee's identity. And then once that search is complete, then I wonder if there's a new sense of grief that comes into play, because then you know more. And so all the possibilities of how your life might have been different, it all goes a million different ways. So you're grappling with different emotions and experiences.
I will say as maybe a piece of advice to people who adopt children when those kids are younger or grow up to be old enough to have some understanding without the details. The parents are usually in a position of kind of providing the story. Here's how we came to get you, or here's what we know about you. But as they get older, and I'd say by the time they get to around when I was curious, by the time you get to mid-teen level, then there's this kind of subtle but important transition. And through the encouragement, we hope, of the parent, is that mom and dad have a story for you. We think it's a true story. It's not untrue. But now the kids got to be able to get their own story together, their version of it. It may not be what mom and dad say, their version.
Yeah.
And I dare say, as you will, a parent of an adopted child, and as children get raised in this way, your story will change too.
Mm-hmm.
20 years from now, the story you have today will be really different.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs will be quite different. But it's that ownership. That's that thing we talk about, having your own voice, having your own personal authority, owning your story. As I've done kind of in spades with writing an actual memoir, is it's everything. I mean, that's you. And it does change over time, even if it's contradictory sometimes, or even then you filled in the blanks with stuff you didn't even know about, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But so important for kids to have that sense of validation that says we trust you to find your own truth.
Mm-hmm. How empowering that is for a child to hear. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, let's end there. Thank you so much, Stephen, for your time. Again, Stephen Rowley on the podcast with us. His memoir is The Lost Coin, A Memoir of Adoption and Destiny. There's so much more that we couldn't cover in our time together. So if anyone's listening and is interested in more about his story, then they can go and find his book. Thanks again, Stephen.
Thank you.
Well, we want to give a huge thanks to both Alicia and Dr. Rowley. We love interviewing and talking with adoptees. And of course, with every adoptee interview that we do, I learn something new. And particularly this conversation just highlighted to me how much adoption has actually changed for maybe the better, or how we maybe made some improvements.
Like more ethical, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, having been born in a birthing center or a place where unwed mothers were kind of shipped off to in Kansas City, I was really unaware of this aspect. And I think you mentioned 30,000 people over many years.
I feel like I read something about that, how Kansas was like the epicenter of where women were sent, like young unwed mothers were sent to place babies.
So I think one thing for me was just culturally and maybe systemically, adoption, I think, has made some steps in the right direction. Gratefully, he was willing to share his story with us and his reunification and connection, which was hard and hard to listen to, but so grateful for his perspective.
Absolutely. I really appreciated hearing his thoughts as an adoptee, as well as an adoptive dad, and hearing how he strikes that balance of acknowledging trauma and working through trauma and ensuring that we're not hiding from these hard parts of adoption, but then also really showing that love tenfold and making those connections. And I just really appreciated hearing his perspectives and thoughts. So big thanks again to Dr. Rowley, and thank you so much for listening to this episode. So before we wrap up, we do have a little bit more to share. We have a research opportunity for any first parents or birth parents who are interested. The First Families Project is a research project that's being conducted by Dr. Paulina Inara-Rodas, as well as Dr. Ashley Larson-Gibby, who is actually my advisor at BYU. So they are wonderful. They're trying to give voice to these experiences that birth moms have. And so if you or someone you know would be interested in participating in their research, please look them up. You can find them on Instagram at First Families Project. So we're going to go ahead and listen to a little more about that research, and then we'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode.
Hi, everyone. My name is Paulina Inara-Rodas, and I'm an assistant professor at Colorado College. Part of the work I do is thinking about how identities and relationships influence the choices we make. I'm here speaking to you today because I just started a new project called the First Families Project with an amazing friend and colleague, Ashley Larson-Gibby at BYU. We've noticed in the literature that there's not a lot that focuses on the specific stories and experiences of birth parents, and we'd like to change that. So we're hoping to find and interview women who place a child for adoption in the U.S. Participants who take part in the study will receive a $50 gift card. So if you're interested, please reach out to us. Our email is firstfamiliesproject@gmail.com. We really would like to speak to you and hear more about your stories and make sure that everyone hears more from birth parents and families and extended families. While we're studying birth mothers now, we also hope to speak to other members of extended birth and first families eventually. So if you're interested in what we're doing or want to take part, please reach out to us. Thank you.